slaves on the hurricane in Briarfield, he was literate, and he particularly liked newspapers. So V saved him the Memphis and New Orleans papers as they came up or down the river on steamboats several days after publication. He started out wary of telling her anything about Noxy, to the point it was hard to glean from his comments that he ever knew her. He'd say safe things like, "After Mr. Davis finished up school, we went to the North Country and stayed an awful long time. We had cold winters at West Point, but up there toward the top of the river, winters kept on going until you worried the back of one and the front of the next might meet in the middle with no summer at all." He said, "Winters, everything freezes up there. You could walk across the river. Play Jesus. It was awful weather." But after he realized V knew a few things about Jeff's courtship of Noxy, had visited her grave as a solemn honeymoon event, and knew her death had wounded Jeff perhaps beyond healing, Pemberton talked more openly, though still only in snips and hints. She could tell Pemberton had liked Noxy, but didn't want to say it. And when V thought about it, his favorable opinion of Noxy carried some weight. She had previously pictured Noxy as a little, half-pretty, sharp-eyed belle, decorated in every fluffy feature of that season's fashion, showing up in the middle of nowhere with her commanding officer daddy, and being as single-minded and witless in her search for a husband among the young officers as a hen pecking at cracked corn. So V held back a while on direct questions about Noxy and went another direction. She made Pemberton awfully uncomfortable one sundown when she said, "I've heard Jeff may have fathered an Indian baby up there. Some claim to know for sure it was a girl." She told Pemberton that people in Washington gossiped about it and that she needed to know how to help Jeff handle the gossip, and that how to do it best would be different depending on whether the story was true or untrue. She reminded Pemberton that managing social matters wasn't where Jeff's light shined brightest, which everyone who ever spent 30 seconds with him knew for a fact. Pemberton said, "Ma'am, some things up the river back then's not for us to cover here between us." V reminded him that when they sat under the tree at sunset, just the two of them talking, neither of them needed to worry about forms of salutation that slowed them down. Just talk the way he and Jeff usually talked. Not necessary to say sir or ma'am every other sentence. Just talk straight. "I don't know anyone else to ask about this," V added. "And besides, I was about 1 year old at the time, and he was a grown man on the wild frontier and very spirited." Pemberton said, "Mr. Davis ought to be the one answering your question." V paused and then said, "I'll take it that the rumors of a child are true. Otherwise, you'd deny them. And I appreciate that you're not going to lie to me." "No, ma'am." "Did you know the mother?" "She was..." He trailed off, waved his hands in front of him. "Let me guess. Pretty? And 17, the way he likes us." "Her daddy was supposed to be from England," Pemberton said, as deflection. "Anyway, she was light brown color and could speak good English, but it sounded funny. A part sock girl by her looks. Most folks up there were sock or fox, and a few Dakota Sioux from on out west. I knew her half-sister some. Real, real pretty woman. They had the same mama, but that sister sure had plenty of Sioux in her." "Meaning what?" V said. "Hard to say. Sioux were real strong fighters." Pemberton said it like a soft, happy memory. "I forgot you were a young man too back then," V said. Pemberton looked off toward the river. He stood and said, "I believe I'll go down to the horse barn before it's too dark to see my hand in front of my face. make sure Jack is set for the night. Jack was V's saddle horse and had been moving a little off in front the previous couple of days. Check his feet, V said. Been planning on it, ma'am, Pemberton said as he walked away. V sat outside past full dark, imagining thousands of half-blood children like Jeff's sock girl and Pemberton's Sioux girl, entering that strange liminal world of native villages and invader forts and tall grass plains and dark fir forests under conditions ranging from rape to rapturous love. Maybe the sock girl's particular Brit father was a tallish blonde fourth son, Cambridge-educated but adventurous and looking to make his own fortune at a far and alien fringe of the New World. And he lingered almost a decade after the birth of his pretty daughter, before fleeing onward toward the Pacific or backing away toward home. During those years he stayed, the girl became fluent in English. So Jeff arrives in the wilderness. Winter, dark, cold, land cut in two by the Mississippi, which seemed not at all the same river that flowed wide and brown by Natchez. And he meets this girl, and an old story only worth summarizing comes to pass. Two young people meet at that moment of accelerative emotion when nature floods our being with urgent demands. So, assume the usual plot elements. Attractiveness. Proximity. Opportunity. She speaks a highly grammatical but oddly accented English, a matter of enunciation for the most part, a carefulness of the tongue in forming certain vowels that creates a music Jeff finds irresistible. Also, assume variations on the usual narrative details, their differing clothes and social ranking and halting manners toward each other, the brief yearning and the quick consummation, including an oblique reference to the mechanics of reproduction. And then, months later, what? No telling whether Jeff considered his next action as moving on or backing away. V was tempted to spin her imagination on and on about the adventures and loves of Jefferson and Pemberton in the wilderness, but she resolved to pause her deductions and inventions and give all that Northwoods material a name and put it away for a while, like a rough draft. Title it something like Jefferson on the Wild Frontier, or Reckless Love, or simply Noxy. A week later, though, she found a bundle of letters from Jeff's courtship with Noxy in a desk drawer. They'd been tied with a red ribbon. V didn't read them, not that day nor thereafter. Their words to each other were not her business, but she assumed Jeff's letters followed his usual heart-throbbing pattern, plunging headlong into French at the end. At 17, V had been young and romantic enough to believe that, given time, she could occupy and eventually possess all the chambers of Jeff's heart, or at least a majority of them. But even during the Mexican War, she had already started to wonder if Noxie's spirit would hover between them, a beautiful ectoplasmic projection throughout their marriage. The Mexican War dragged on, and so did the war between Briarfield and the Hurricane. Politics and diplomacy between the two plantations became so bleak that Jeff asked for leave to make an epic journey 1,000 miles to forge peace at home. His commanding officer was once again Noxie's father, Zachary Taylor, a general at the time. In Mexico, Jeff and the general became friends, and Taylor allowed that between them his daughter had been the better judge of young men. He sent Jeff off with his blessings to do what needed to be done in Mississippi. Jeff traveled by horseback from Monterey to the coast and then by ship across the northern Gulf to New Orleans, and then by steamboat up the river to the Bend. He showed up with blood in his eyes mad equally at V and Brother Joe. During the 3 weeks Jeff stayed at Briarfield, he and V fought nightly over the will, its surprises and secrets, the unimagined complications of property ownership, her lack of any inheritance or protections against the future. He spent most of every day huddled with old Joe in his office, conspiring about how to deal with her. When Jeff's leave ran out, Briarfield and the hurricane had failed to reach a peace treaty or even a ceasefire. He left V with a chilly peck on her cheek on the porch, and V did not join him in the carriage to see him off at the dock. From Jeff's arrival until his departure, she slept in a separate bedroom. She told him that the crudest way to put it was that if he died in Mexico, leaving her to the predations of Joseph, she intended to save herself for her second husband. Whatever grim transaction a second marriage might involve, dragging a child into the negotiations would be an unwelcome impediment. Or, leaving future husbands out of it, imagine her bed and board entirely in the hands of old Joe, and Jeff's child equally without inheritance so long as Joe kept the deed to Briarfield. Just as he turned to leave, V said to him, "How can I bring children into the world knowing the brutal, mercantile family they would fall into, holding money over all our heads to control us? Old Joe already controls so many destinies, his house full of women and fields full of slaves." All Jeff could say in response was, "I think you're exaggerating." After a stretch of weeks alone, V wrote to her mother, "I have become quite a savage, and I tear my food in silence." A few months before the end of the Mexican War, Jeff came home wounded and walking with a cane, the great hero of the Battle of Buena Vista, where his strategy and leadership and courage would enter the canon of military history. In Natchez, they rode together through town in an open carriage heaped to their armpits with flowers. All the way up from New Orleans, in every town, brass bands and dignitaries and barbecues and salutes of guns and cannons welcomed them. Jeff hid his true pain to the extent that his limp seemed a theatrical affectation and the cane a fashion accessory. All along the way, he made speeches to the crowds. Stop by stop, as they moved upriver, he grew more confident and more powerful as a speaker. One newspaper said that if he ran for the Senate, he would go through the state like a bolt of lightning. But settled back at Briarfield, it became clear how badly he had been injured. Pieces of bone kept working themselves out of his wounds, and the fight with Brother Joe weighed heavy on his mind. He wanted V to play along. Leave everything for Joseph to sort out someday. Trust him. But there Jeff was, his foot and lower leg wounded to the marrow, and V picking bone shards out of the mess every morning with tweezers, knowing any day it could go septic and carry him away to the next world. All the years later, living in the 20th century, she's taken care of herself long enough to know how it's done. What she wanted at 21 was either to have the security promised as part of the deal when marrying an older man of property, or else to be left alone to live her life without some master like old Joe lording over her. Jeff, though, wanted peace at home and power out in the world. He got the latter almost immediately, without even having to go through an election when one of Mississippi's old senators died in office, as they often do. War hero Jeff was immediately appointed to the position by the governor. As Jeff prepared to leave for Washington, he gave V a choice. Go along with Joe's system of management and accompany her husband to Washington, or carry on the fight and stay right there at the bend by herself. It was a mean ultimatum, knowing how much she loved Washington and that the wife of a senator would have even more access to the best parties and the most interesting people. They had mostly lived apart for the past 2 years, and if V didn't agree to Jeff's terms, they would spend most of another year separated. V decided to dig in and fight on, besieged at Fort Briarfield. Grim times after Jeff left. Letters passed between them declaring love, but ending in threats. He urged her to become less bitter toward his family and declared that if her behavior didn't change, it would be impossible ever to live together again. She sent back letters suggesting maybe that would be for the best. She thought for a while about getting a puppy for company, a warm body to snuggle with when she stayed up late reading. But eventually, she decided that at the bend, it would grow to be some vicious hunting dog chasing deer to exhaustion and death. At Jeff's insistence, Joseph's horrible, patched-on wing finally rose from the ground, and a very worn and bleak woman with 4 insane children moved in. Even the hour of supper became so full of running and screaming and crying that V began taking her evening meal alone in her room or out at the table under the big tree. But she kept fighting Jeff and Brother Joe and the damned will all along the way. Jeff had a hard time alone in Washington, and it wasn't just that he lacked social skills. He nearly got into a duel with a mere congressman, and it took his old father-in-law, now President Zachary Taylor, to calm the two men. Then, shortly afterward, on Christmas Day, Jeff and his fellow senator from Mississippi, Henry Foote, both living at Brown's Hotel, fell into disagreement on either a political or a constitutional issue. Jeff forever remained too embarrassed to talk about it, but V heard in letters from acquaintances and friends that he and Foote had been drinking pretty strongly from breakfast onward. Jeff, who still walked with a cane, began fist-fighting Foote, a rolling-in-the-floor kind of fight. When they became winded and stood up, they threatened to kill one another for a while, and then, on his way out of the room, Foote turned around and claimed he was the one who struck the first blow. Then Jeff got right in his face, and they threatened to kill one another all over again until Foote struck Jeff, and then Jeff knocked Foote to the floor and beat on him until the other members of the legislative branch dragged them apart. At which point Jeff, very cold-blooded, said he had 2 loaded pistols in his room and suggested they go up and lock the door from the inside and settle the matter for good. Foote declined. A few days later, when the event became public, both of them, politicians to the marrow, agreed to call their brawl a Christmas frolic, a regrettable celebration of the Savior's birth. V didn't know what all was going on with Jeff at that time and didn't much care. But letters kept coming from friends sharing gossip, such as that in the middle of the night, probably drunk, he'd fallen off a bridge or down a bank into a ditch and limped around the Capitol for a week, with his head and hands wrapped in white bandages. Their own letters to each other remained icy during that entire session. But it seemed clear Jeff needed a steadying hand. At a long break in the congressional calendar, Jeff came to his senses and arrived back home with a draft of a new agreement among the 3 warring parties, a treaty wherein Joseph saved face and V got a true stake in Davis Bend should Jeff die ahead of her, with Joseph having a right to make the first offer to buy her share should she want to sell out. An entertaining negotiation to anticipate, V having something Joe wanted and the power to say no, which, regrettably, never came to pass, since she has far outlived both brothers. When Jeff and V left together for the next session of Congress, V never again lived at Briarfield for more than a few weeks at a time. But the night after the signing of the peace papers, Jeff opened a couple of bottles of Old Bordeaux and made a ceremony of burning the previous will in the bedroom fireplace, and V felt like the second half of an incomplete wedding had finally been performed, that for better or worse, they were linked and committed, and that she had become a full shareholder in her own future. Gossips speculated as to why Jeff and V went years without her bearing a child, and then suddenly she seemed to stay pregnant most of the time. It didn't seem mysterious to V, and that second will and second wedding ceremony by the fire had a great deal to do with it, a reconciliation of hearts and bodies that lasted for some years. The return to Washington would have seemed triumphant to V, except that soon after they arrived, news came from the Bend that Pemberton had died very unexpectedly. Jeff hardly spoke of Pemberton's death, but he brooded for a few days and then just said, "I don't know which of us hated that North Woods weather the most." The news of Pemberton hit V hard, deeper than she would have thought. She couldn't stop feeling guilty that she hadn't been there for his burial, couldn't stop remembering how he had tried to divert Joseph's rage, couldn't stop feeling exposed and at risk knowing he was gone. But she kept her feelings tamped, since no one, especially Jeff, would understand her grief for Pemberton. There wasn't a vocabulary to explain their relationship to other people. "There still aren't words now," V says. "But you could try. It sounds like Pemberton protected you the best he could when you didn't have anyone else on your side. That's exactly the way it was. And when he died, it felt almost like Winchester had passed. Like a father had gone for good, but I couldn't say that." She thought a moment and then said, "I don't know why, but I remember one evening Pemberton telling me he wouldn't be around for a day or two. That he was going to visit a man he knew, an old friend, on a plantation 20 miles away. He said he'd gotten word the man had been beaten badly because, after he'd groomed a horse, his master had wiped a white handkerchief down its neck, and it came back dirty. I was so young. I mostly felt happy that he trusted me enough to tell me where he was going and why. I told him I'd never been around those horrors, and always felt like they were mostly stories. He said, 'It's not one thing everywhere. People act their natures. Some plantations beat bloody every chance they get. Other places a man can go off 2 or 3 days to visit a girlfriend miles away, and when he gets back, the master just says, "I thought you'd fallen in the river and drowned." "Yes," James says. "I heard plenty of true stories from freed people when I first started teaching. A little kindness and a lot of horror. My first real job as a teacher, making my living at it, I was 19. A student of mine, she'd been enslaved in Maryland. She was about 50, just learning to read. Her name was Martha." James tells V that Martha was body servant to a young mistress who trusted her and chattered at length every day, telling every dirty secret about her disgusting older husband, every flirtation she had with handsome younger men at parties, her occasional adulterous flings, every thread of gossip in the county. Martha dressed her mistress every day, from bare skin to composed bell, arranged her hair, applied powder and rouge, told her how beautiful she was. And yet, the mistress sold Martha's 10-year-old daughter to traders for $700. She believed Martha would get over her crying and forget about the girl. And Martha did get over the crying because she had to. But she told James that not one day of her life passed without grieving for her daughter and wondering which was worse, believing her child dead or imagining the fate that might have awaited her. And still every day, having to touch with care the woman who inflicted such pain. Inhuman, V says. But that's an easy word. We've been doing that sort of thing to each other all through history, back past the pyramids. Humans are inhuman. Whether it's by direct action or by acceptance of a horrible action as normal. That godlike long view is fine. Sometimes we need it. But hearing a story like Martha's made me want to kill somebody right then. James pauses and then says, anyway, let's circle back to what you call the axle of your life. Maybe the axle of mine, too, when all that old order was in the middle of collapsing. Writing on the Wall, 1865. After their moment of luxury in Abbeville, the fugitives traveled west, crossed the Savannah River into Georgia. The town of Washington, Georgia, had once been pretty, but it had filled with refugees fleeing north from Sherman's wasteland. Garbage in the streets, stores looted. V's group kept right on going and spent the night in the little white country chapel, sleeping on the pews. Then, through a stretch of beautiful broken country, slow going for a whole week. Wet weather and bad roads. Then they fell off the map for 3 days of greenwood country and tangles of curvy single track, 7 or 8 miles a day at best, but pretty camp places. Not mountains, but low ridges, water running over big rocks in the streams. Little towns blurred together. But V remembers a place called Mayfield. She wanted to stop and buy a house and let the children grow up there. Delray and Burton and Jimmy Limber never owned their tiredness. Go 12 hours with little food and no rest, banging down the rutted roads dazed and numb, and then ask them if they were ready to stop for the night, and they'd each say, I could keep going a while. Like having a contest to see who could persist, who fell in his footsteps last. You tired, little man? Delray said. Fading? Do we need to stop? Jimmy said, Nope, I can go. V said, Delray, are you hinting you could use a nap? Jimmy can probably figure out how to drive this rig if he needs to. Delray said, I believe he could if he had a little teaching. Jimmy looked far down the road and said nothing. Delray widened and lifted his arms, spreading the long, drooping leather reins, and said, Come here and spell me then. Jimmy looked at V, and she nodded yes. He ducked under and stood in front of Delray and took hold of the reins. The backs of his hands were still childhood chubby, to the extent that the knuckles at the base of his fingers were like 4 dimples in his plump handbacks. The reins were wide as his palms. Guide him easy, Delray said. Don't pull and don't flap. They have plenty of sense on their own. Use the reins to make suggestions. Don't go yanking and checking them unless they give you no other choice. Got it? Sure, Jimmy said. Well, I believe I'll take me a nap then. Wake me up when we get to Florida. You'll know we're there when you start seeing alligators. Delray slouched down a little on the wagon bench and pretended to snore. A night later at camp, almost bedtime, they heard horses trotting on the road and then heard them stop. As they had planned, Ellen eased the children off into the woods out of earshot, and Delray hid outside the ring of campfire light with his shotgun and pistol ready in case of trouble. At the campfire, V and Burton were joined by 3 bummers, raiders, deserters, or killers, whatever you want to call leftovers and scavengers from Sherman's army. Maybe they were just stray northern shop clerks conscripted against their wills a year before and had spent their few months of war trying to figure out which end of the gun you aimed at the enemy and now were lost on their way home. Except that's not at all how they looked and acted. They looked like they wanted what you had and would kill you to get it, but would slightly prefer you just handed it over. Burton sat on a log with his right hand loose by his side so he could reach his pistol. He talked polite. Had they come from the east? Were things bad there? Or from back toward Atlanta? He and V had agreed to be calm, friendly, not be angered by anything people said until they made their intentions clear, not react to taunts or insults or rude words. If it went bad, hit the dirt fast and give Delray room to fill the air with lead shot. The man with the black beard and the red-haired man talked vague. The thin, pale man stayed silent. One thing ran clear in their voices. They did not come from around here. V said, "I can't place your accents exactly, but I'm going to guess north of Baltimore and south of Boston."
"Easy guess," the red-haired man said. "Most of the world's somewhere between the two."
He stood up and walked about 5 steps from the fire and pulled his breeches down on one side until it seemed like he intended to strip bare. But he stopped, with just his hip exposed to the firelight, and on it, a big, pearly, welted letter D. He patted it like a pet and said, "Supposed to teach me a lesson. Down here you probably just shoot deserters in the head. We brand them." The black beard man said, "Good God, you can't piss right here." The red-haired man turned his back and looked over his shoulder and said, "I'm not aiming to piss right here. I'm aiming to piss way over yonder." He made a graceful gesture with his left hand and arm, the smooth arc of a dolphin rising to take a breath of air, and then he let fly. The black beard man smiled, a white flash of teeth, and then his mouth snapped shut, and the lower half of his face became nothing but beard again.
He said, "Doesn't really matter if you people know where we're from or not, but we're from Pennsylvania. Red and me got conscripted halfway through the war. It was us set fire to Atlanta and left on the Decatur Road with everything burning down. Blue sky ahead, black smoke behind. From there we angled southeast and left a black stripe nearly 100 miles wide all the way across this shithole state to the ocean. We were a big machine. Took 15,000 horses and mules to haul our stuff. Just picture that. We had orders to seize everything we could eat, everything our horses and mules could eat, with a surplus of minimum 2 weeks. We took all their beeves and pigs and chickens, whatever crops still stood in the fields, whatever farmers had put away, dried and canned and smoked. We had orders not to enter their houses and steal stuff, unless we felt they'd worked against us, burnt bridges or hid food. Entirely up to our discretion, so that rule didn't mean much. At big plantations, no rules at all, just wide open. We were free to bust in wherever we thought there might be something valuable. Cash money, boxes of jewelry, cupboards full of silver forks and spoons. In small places, you'd quit bothering because all you'd find was just pitiful cigar boxes of low-number coins."
"And him?" V said, looking at the pale man. "He's from Pennsylvania, too?"
"I don't know. Somewhere. He's seen the whole show from the start. Name a bad fight, and he was probably in it. He's about done now."
"Done with the war," Burton said. Red said,
"With everything you could name. He's looking to avenge himself against the world. I'm sure they'll welcome you heroes back home with brass bands," Burton said.
The bearded man said,
"How many have you killed the past 4 years? We've shot so many men better than you. It's sickening."
Burton didn't answer.
"What did you all do before the war?" V said.
Red said,
"Shoe factory."
The bearded man tipped his head toward the pale man and said, "Foundry. And for me, stockyard."
"What is it you're wanting from us?" Burton said.
The bearded man smiled his quick, white smile. Red said, "What you got?" The pale man leaned into the firelight. He looked consumptive, blue around the eyes, and fragile. He stood at least 6 feet, but wouldn't have gone better than 120. He had been hit bad in the face. Every piece of skin you could see had scars either gouged or burned. His mouth drew up on one side over his back teeth in a permanent wolfish grin. The eye on that side lay dead and milky in his face. About the only thing left normal about him was his nose and the other eye, and that good eye was the scariest thing about him. It looked out at the world like he was meeting God and didn't give a damn how he might be judged. The pale man looked at V and said, "We've met." He talked whispery from his throat, with a hiss of air from the part of his mouth that failed to close because his lips on that side were gone. V looked at Burton, and then before she could catch herself, she glanced off to the woods where Ellen and the children and Delray hid. "Forgive me," V said, "but I don't recall when that would have been."
"Richmond,"
V said. "Yes?"
"Libby Prison Hospital. I'd been cut up by canister. Lost a deal of blood, and the first part of this happened then."
He raised a hand and patted it against the left side of his face, netted with scars like a sheet of caul fat. He said,
"Richmond doctors told me I ought to get square with my maker. You came in and acted like the smell of wounds didn't sicken you. Fed me cookies and tea and held my hand. You kissed me on the head and said you were sorry."
"What's your name?" V said.
"Jens."
"Well, I'm still sorry, and I'm glad you made it, Jens." He puffed out air from the broken side of his mouth.
"Made it," he said. "I can't go home. I'd have to wear a mask to walk down the street."
"But you're still the same person inside."
"That right there is bullshit," Jen said. "And you say it to me knowing that I know it's bullshit. Good God, nothing's left of me."
"Go home and see. People might be better than you think."
"I always wondered why you were there," Jen said. "One minute your people are ripping me apart. The next minute, kisses and cookies. Better for you if you went to the rebel hospitals."
"I did that too."
"Boo-hoo," the bearded man said. "Couple of months from now, after all this gets settled, maybe we'll start robbing banks and trains and we'll all be wearing masks."
Jen said to the bearded man,
"Let her be. We're done here."
He stood and looked at V and said,
"I'm calling us even."
He walked to his horse and mounted and rode off. The other two looked at each other and shrugged and walked to their horses. Before they rode away, Red said,
"Must be your lucky day, folks."
One afternoon before supper, the boys had been hunkering on their knees, knuckled down at a marble ring they'd scratched in the dirt with a stick. But Jeffy's taw was a big, shiny steel ball bearing, and Jimmy and Billy had only glass shooters. Jeffy had run the table 2 or 3 times, and his jacket pockets bulged full of marbles he'd won. The younger boys claimed Jeffy was cheating, and all of a sudden they were wallowing in the red dirt, bashing at each other with their little soft fists.
"Do you want to handle this or let me?"
V said, all irritable. Ellen said, "You sit. I'll go see whether a spanking's what they really need right now." She stepped over beyond the campfire to the marble ring and broke up the fight and marched the boys to a fallen log. Ellen sat first and then thumped Jeffy down on one side, Billy and Jimmy on the other. She began asking questions, and they all answered at the same time, and soon Their chins quivered, and parallel tear tracks ran down their dusty cheeks. V watched close, but couldn't hear much of what any of them said. Before long, the boys stood, and Ellen nudged them underhanded on their way. They ran to the edge of the woods and started a new game that involved throwing big pine cones at tree trunks and then at one another. When Ellen came back to the fire, V said, "What's your secret?" "I'm not telling. But I will say, wading in slapping is not the only answer." Georgia is a tall state when you aim to go top to bottom in wagons with a bunch of children. For a week, the journey became a nightmare of repetition, every day the same routine, same landscape, nothing changing but the weather. The fugitives probably hadn't advanced more than 40 miles after meeting the marauders when two boys, about 15 or 16, rode up from behind, one astride a mule and another on a halfway good dun gelding, its legs striped as a zebra and a black streak running from its forelock and mane down its back through its tail. The mule rider was a tall, black-headed goose of a boy, and the other one middle-sized and blondish. As they came alongside, they looked the fugitive group over good, and when they reached the ambulance and saw V sitting beside the driver, the tall one said, "Afternoon, Mrs. Davis." He reached up and touched the brim of his hat, about like greeting an acquaintance on the street. Delray immediately pulled up the mules and moved his right hand near the short double-barrel shotgun he kept by his leg. Burton rode between the boys and the ambulance. The canvas of the ambulance had been raised a foot above the sideboards for air, and four curious faces peeped out. Ellen held Winnie in one arm and eased the others back and rolled down the fabric. "Where are you coming from?" Burton said. The tall boy, real caustic, said, "Well, greetings to you, too. We're down from Richmond. Back in Washington, Georgia, Jeff Davis gave us all cadets back pay, or at least a fraction of what they owed us, and told us to go home." "President Davis," Burton said. "Not anymore, he's not," the boy said. "Did you come looking for us?" Burton said. "It's on our way home." "You're Navy cadets," Burton said. "Yes, sir," the smaller boy said. "Were you still there when Richmond fell?" Burton said. "Yes, sir." "Y'all got names?" Delray said. The tall one said he was Ryland, and the smaller blonde was Bristol. Ryland said, "We left town on the train the president escaped on, like fleeing hell." Bristol said, "We've mostly been under General Duke since Greensboro, after the rail bridges got blown up and we had to travel by horse and wagon and afoot." "Is Basil all right?" V asked. "Yes, ma'am," Bristol said. "Last I saw of him, General Duke had a metal mirror tacked to a tree and was shaving and looking like he was going to a ball." "And Judah?" "Mr. Benjamin was telling jokes and smoking big Cuban cigars," Ryland said. "And reciting poems," Bristol said, "especially The Death of Wellington." Ryland said, "I heard him say that one so many times, I remember a line that goes, 'Hush, the dead march wails in the people's ears.' And then something about sobs and tears and black earth yawning. The way Mr. Benjamin said that rhyme, 'ears and tears,' was pretty funny." "I expect it was," V said. "And Mr. Davis?" Ryland said, "He didn't look good at all for a while. Then after Charlotte, when things really went bad and it was clear the war was lost, he got sort of happy seeming and rode along talking about horse bits and bird dogs and books he read a long time ago. Except probably wasn't figuring he'd soon have a fat bounty on his head." "Bounty," V said. "For conspiring to kill Lincoln. And, goes without saying, for treason."
"Lincoln's been killed?"
"Yes, ma'am. And by a Southerner.
The big money reward's on your husband, $100,000. But they claimed pretty much anybody close to him or high in the government aided and abetted and conspired, so they got a price on them, too. Clay, Stevens, everybody big. You too, Mr. Harrison. $25,000 apiece. That's nothing but rumors along the road, Del Rey said. Not exactly, Bristol said. We read it for ourselves. General Duke showed us a newspaper before they paid us and cut us loose. Burton stepped his horse over to the ambulance. He and Del Rey and V mumbled about the boys, the requirements to get in the academy and the training the cadets would have gotten, not to mention the family connections they would have needed in the first place. And since the fugitive party had dwindled to such a small hard core, they could use help. Burton circled his horse back to the boys and said, "You wouldn't mind riding with us for a few days, would you? If what you say is true, we could travel faster if we had help making fires and washing pots and pans and dishes, taking care of the horses and that sort of thing, doing whatever comes up. If you're willing, we'll be making camp in a couple of hours and we'll put you right to work." "Happy to be of service," Bristol said. "We can't pay much at all," Burton said. Ryland laughed and said, "That also goes without saying." V said, "Maybe later you can tell us about that last day in Richmond. We haven't gotten reliable news for a long time. Third or fourth hand at best." They stopped early to camp and cook supper and feed the horses and mules, and to let the children run around before dark. Also, to plan how to deal with the latest threat, how to avoid people, how to become invisible. They made camp a good way off the road in Pine Woods by an abandoned hayfield greening up after winter. Ellen cooked, and the Navy boys untacked and fed horses and mules and took them in pairs on lead lines to graze. The children played in the new grass at the edge of the field, happy to be free from the wagon bed. They chased each other, and Maggie spun with her arms out until she fell over dizzy and stared at the sky until the world stopped whirling. And then the boys all did it, too. They cartwheeled and tried to walk on their hands and tumbled like circus acrobats. Jimmy showed them how to pluck a wide blade of fresh grass and hold it just right between the joints of their thumbs and blow across it and work their mouths to make high-pitched buzzing music. V sat on the trunk of a big deadfall short-leaf pine and watched them and looked across the hayfield, its perspective flowing away in an hourglass shape, the borders and pinched waste delineated by dark, tall incursions of pine wood. The sun fell low, and the light in the sky, above the far end of the field, stained upward from apricot to indigo. Tree shadows stretched across the new grass. How wonderful if that could be sufficient to our needs. A vision of static beauty without motion or change. Burton and Del Rey came and sat on either side of her, and she cupped their wrists with her hands and gripped them tight. Ellen came and stood with her arms crossed, holding her elbows. V said, "That can't be true. What they said about Lincoln and the bounties." "Exaggeration, probably," Del Rey said. "But smoke and fire. There'll be truth somewhere in it." Tears welling in her eyes, she said, "We're all lost now. They will punish us for the war, fair enough. But Lincoln would have let us up easy. Now they'll hunt us all down. Even the friends who helped us in Abbeville will face charges. The Burts and Mary Chestnut arrested for aiding and abetting. Every preacher where we slept in a chapel to get out of the rain. That farm where the widow let us sleep in her dry barn." Del Rey said, "Ma'am, we don't know what's coming behind us. Worry about staying in motion, going forward. They don't catch us, they can't hurt us.
We make it to Florida and find a boat running south down the Gulf. Nothing they can do. We'll be sailing blue water, eating fried grouper instead of moldy old bacon and musty grits. Skip down through the Keys, across the Florida Straits to Havana. After that, Yankees can call us whatever brand of criminal they care to. We start over again, without reference to their opinions. I ain't scared. I've lost everything I had 2 times already and built it back. I'm not so old I can't live through it one more time, and I'm the oldest one among us by at least 10 years.
It's not just me, V said. There's family to consider. Even if we make it out, reunion would be hard.
Not harder than if we're all in prison.
Burton said, Delray, no need to be alarming. Worst case, even if these stories are true and we're caught, the Federals won't charge either of you with treason or conspiracy. They'll try to make you think they will, but they won't. And I know I didn't conspire, and neither did Mr. Davis.
Delray said, they'll sure charge you and try to hang you, no matter what the truth is.
B thought a minute and then said to Burton, so, Havana, you'll come with me?
Yes, Burton said, of course.
Ellen hadn't said anything. She'd mostly looked down the field. So when the men were gone, V stood beside her and asked what she was thinking.
I'm trying to figure that out. When we left Richmond, Cuba never entered my mind.
I don't know what to say. If we make it to Florida and find a boat, I want you to come, but only if you want to.
I could get down there and not be able to get back, Ellen said.
That's possible, V said.
I'll have to study on it.
After supper, children settled in the wagon bed for the night. The fugitives sat around a campfire burning low, and the Navy boys started talking, and they mostly told their story over the top of each other. Bristol started by saying, "That last day was terrible, no doubt about it. Everybody had to own that we were beat." The boys went on to describe the fall of Richmond, how everybody in the city, to some degree, seemed blistered from the loss of a long war and the failure of a shaky, made-up government created to represent the worst features of a culture. Leaders busy packing to run. Food scarce, money worthless. Roads clogged with scared refugees knowing the Federal Army rode hard just hours away. And after nightfall, the city began to go up in flames. But, on the other hand, Bristol and Rylan were 16 and armed. Chaos thrilled like a great adventure. That night, 8 cadets, 4 to a skiff, were given big casks of black powder and cans of coal oil and told to row out to the CSS Patrick Henry on the James River and blow her up and burn her down, preferably in such a way as to impede water traffic for the Federals. Sad, yes. She had been their training ship and mostly their home for over a year. But blowing things up, especially when they're large and important, thrills at any age, and especially at 16. On board, they gathered all the stray weapons and ammunition they could find quickly and heaped them into the skiffs, and then lit the fuses and hustled to row away. They were almost to the riverbank when the powder blew, and then the oil cans caught with such a great sucking combustion and eruption of yellow flame that they stopped rowing and cheered in pure anarchic joy. Flames lit the water like sheets of crumpled gold leaf under sunlight, and then waves broke around them and bucked the skiffs until the boys gripped the gunwales to keep from being thrown into the river. Rylan looked at the burning ship and said, "We sure hell done it now." Soon as they reached dry ground, the 8 heroes who sank the mighty PH stood at the riverbank and watched irreverently and in awe as their ship burned toward the waterline. Then they looked around for fellow cadets to praise them and for officers to tell them what to do next. But officers were not to be found. Important business elsewhere, no doubt. Back toward the city, undersides of clouds shone amber and red and yellow with buildings afire.
Ryland said, "'Pears like we'll call our own orders from here on."
Nobody agreed with him aloud. Some of those boys weren't more than 14 and didn't know what to say. Ryland, though, had decided he never intended to trust rulers again. No bosses and generals and presidents, no matter what government they came from. He felt entirely able to judge every man above him in the chain of command, all the way to Wood and Lee and Davis.
Bristol said, "Let's go see what's happening in town before we commit too far."
Ryland rattled through the weapons and ammunition they had claimed from the ship and came up with an ugly, sawed-off 12-gauge. He held it up to the boys and said, "See this scattergun? Soon as I get the material, I'm going to pack me some shells with shot big as sweet peas. Nobody's going to cross me then."
With nowhere else to go, they distributed the rest of the weaponry and walked toward the train station for lines running toward Danville and Point South, the direction of home. The city whirled all crazy. Little impromptu squads of people rushed around looting houses and stores and warehouses. People ran down the middle of the street, carrying blanket bundles of clinking valuables slung over their shoulders, silverware and crystal and china. People cradled precious breakables in their arms like babies. One woman strode along with 6 or 7 fancy hats stacked on her head, holding her arms straight out and palms up for balance. A man hauled an awkward purple velvet tete-a-tete love seat by himself, with just the aid of a muslin tump line running from the hind legs across his forehead. A man and woman dragged a great crystal chandelier the size of a cabriolet behind them, leaving a trail of broken, faceted glass sparkling in the firelight. City officials unwisely ordered bars and hotels to break open their barrels of whiskey and beer and pour them into the gutters. Therefore, many folks sat on curbstones dipping drinks with looted china cups and crystal goblets, or just supping primitive from their two hands. Flames jumped gaps from building to building, and the fire built minute by minute. Smoke and the crackle of burning wood and booms of exploded munitions filled the air. Along the way, the boys heard rumors spreading that the entire treasury, $1 million in gold and silver bars from the several mints, and also canvas bags packed heavy with floor sweepings, fingernail pairings of silver and gold, waited on the platform to be loaded onto a rail car, and that the president and his cabinet were fleeing south with the treasure, leaving the capital looted and burned out so that the Yankees, and also the inhabitants, would be left with nothing. Other people claim the president's wife had already left with most of the treasure days ago. By the time the cadets rolled into the train station, they found a mob ruling the platform, dark-minded and globbing together in cohorts, talking loud and vicious. 2 trunks sat by the rail lines, and treasure hunters beat open the locks with their pistol butts and pulled out suits of men's clothes and some big underpants and socks. The cadets had been dipping from the gutters themselves and had just blown up a goddamn full-size side-wheel steamship, and they were heavily armed. So they had achieved a certain mood under which the opinions of their elders factored small. Firelight from burning buildings lit everything around the station lurid. Brick walls stood bloody red, washed over with black shadows and flashing yellow from explosions rising in the sky over toward Tredegar Ironworks. The train waited at the platform. It stubbed off short. Only a black locomotive and a wood car and 2 passenger cars and a stock car and 1 blue box car at the end. Men loaded 6 horses into the stock car, and they clattered up the ramp with their ears back and yanking against their lead lines. The train appeared to be waiting on something or somebody, either the treasure, if it wasn't already gone, or the officials of the government, or both. Pressure built up in the boiler, and then periodically whooshed away in clouds of steam,
that broke white against all the hell colors lighting that particular instant in history. Ryland said, "I believe if I was hiding treasure, I'd put it in the stock car. Let Rob